It's a gift to have an extended conversation about these issues because they're complicated. And that's why the name of the podcast that John and I do is Going Deep, because you really do have to go deep to get to where we need to go. Oops, I've got a little clicker today. I got to remember to use it. So today we're going to dig in a little bit more to the kind of ways that congregations and sports have affected each other. My first call to ministry was in the Chicago Presbytery at First Presbyterian Church of Libertyville. John was coaching for the Chicago Bears at the time. While we were there, he became the youngest coordinator ever to coach in the NFL. At age 30, he was the offensive coordinator. We had some great years there, and we had some tough times there as well. One of the first things that I noticed in my new job there was that we didn't have enough time to really have a good adult Sunday school class time. It was too rushed. It was really an afterthought for the church. So I made a suggestion to the session that we extend that time and make worship start later. And they said, well, we can't do that because of Bears games. And I said, if I can be late to a Bears game, you can be late to a Bears game. And they said, then you have to get up and say that to the congregation. And I did. And we did it together. But there was something about me saying that I was willing to be late or to even miss, you know, maybe even miss the whole game because I wouldn't be able to get down there in time if we started later, that helped the church, I don't know, loosen its grip a little bit. Even when it's kind of in jest, they still didn't want to change the schedule. And I think that really is one of the struggles for us as Christians today. We make choices. We make choices, and we're going to talk some today about those choices and the kind of unlearning that we need to do around what the culture is supposed to do to accommodate our choices. So as I said, I was ordained in the Chicago Presbytery. John and I have been married for over 20 years. He was in the NFL for 12 years, and let's see, that makes 14 in Division I. So, is that 26? Yeah. Thank you. In football, there's something called conflict of assignment, and definitely our vocations were a conflict of assignment. Sundays were very difficult those first 12 years of our marriage because of the NFL. We really struggled to just make our life work. John would try everywhere they were to find a church that had an 8:30 Sunday service so he could go before the game. I tried my best to, you know, get to games when I could. But it was difficult, and we really kind of lived separate lives. When we lived in Oakland, when he coached for the Raiders, I had a job in a church down in downtown Oakland. And finally, we had to hire a nanny to take care of our kids. And when I realized the nanny was not only picking my kids up from school, but doing our laundry, cooking all the meals, walking the dog, tucking the kids in at night, I just felt, you know, this is not working. We left the NFL to try to take back Sundays. Well, it didn't quite work that way. John still had to go to work on Sundays. He could go to church for a little while, but it was a struggle. It really was. There wasn't any way in which these two things were meshing with one another. As Felicia said in my introduction, I'm the fourth generation ordained in the Presbyterian Church. And I grew up in a family that, you know, we just kind of understood Sundays as church days. And I grew up in a town and in a culture where that was laid out for us. There were no stores open. Nobody had anything on Sundays. There were no soccer games on Sundays. There were no birthday parties on Sundays. I mean, and if you didn't go to church, you better be sick, so you don't go out if you didn't go to church. My grandfather and grandmother didn't allow my dad to play Legion baseball because they played on Sundays. It was just deeply ingrained in us that that's the way Sunday was supposed to be. So definitely when I married an NFL coach, it was just a rude awakening that we were going to have to fight a little bit harder than I ever had before to practice our faith. The other thing that I noticed was because I was occupying these really dissonant spaces on Sunday, I would go to church and we would, you know, talk about love and we would talk about community and we'd talk about peace and we'd talk about caring for each other. And then I would go to the stadium and people were like screaming at me that my husband should die and they were going to shoot him and he was so stupid and, you know, and these were people on my team. It was really, really stressful. I can't tell you how stressful it was. And it changed the way I felt about the world around me. I really just became a lot more introverted. I didn't want to go to the grocery store. I didn't want to look at the paper. I didn't want to go on the internet. I didn't want to engage. I didn't want to turn on the radio. I remember one time driving down the road, and I made the mistake of turning on the radio, and I heard the announcer saying, "John Shoup is just so tired and stressed out. He's doing a terrible job, and it's because he has 4 children. And I'm like, we have 1 kid. I mean, at the time, we had 1 child. I'm like, what is he talking about? I'm going to call him. And I started to dial the number, you know, to call in and say, you know, this is his wife. We have 1 child. Like, at least get that right, you know. And as I was on hold for them to take the call, he said, "Well, I just want to say, give a shout out again. Here we are at Hooters. It's so great to see all this eye candy." And I was like, no, I'm not going to engage with this. But there was this constant push and pull of how do I take up space in this world as a Christian? How do I do that? Now we're parents of kids that play sports. And so even though we're out of the NFL and now even out of college football, the struggle continues just for the practice of Christianity. When my kids were little, I would tell the coaches at the beginning of the season, we won't participate in a game that's scheduled on a Sunday morning. If it's a tournament, then I understand it. But if it is scheduled, if you had a choice and you scheduled it on a Sunday, we won't be there. And they said, well, you know, your kid will take the consequences. And sometimes they did, and that's okay, you know? I mean, it's not their job to make me feel okay about my choices, and sometimes my children were penalized for that. And I actually think that was an important lesson for them, even though it was hard and they got really mad at me a few times about that. But I just feel like families make choices, the choices are hard, and we don't necessarily get affirmation on those choices from the sports culture or the larger culture. We've talked a little bit about our decision to leave and football. We can talk a little bit more about that later if you want to. I'm not going to go into that much right now. I think you get the gist that this whole question isn't just an abstract concept to me. This is my life. This is something that I've really lived and died and struggled with. It's given me a lot of joy, and it's given me a lot of angst and worry, and it's given me a lot of also just refining in my faith. You know, what is at stake for me? I think sports encroaching on Sundays are an easy villain for Christians. And I think it's not all our fault that we feel kind of victimized by this, because, you see, we came of age in a country that accommodated us, that accommodated our faith, that made our faith work. And that's never where Christianity really found its integrity. So I happen to think where we are right now is a gift. Christians hit our stride on the margins. That's where Jesus sets the pace. That's where Jesus really could be seen and heard with most potency. So I don't totally understand Christians that are so indignant about the culture not accommodating our needs. I feel like that's as it should be. It helps us remember that we should never be too cozy with the powers and principalities. Let's see. I want to look at a few ways today that Christianity and congregations have been in conversation. And, you know, as a theologian, I try to be someone who always lets redemptive opportunities be at the center of how I do my work. But I've found in this conversation that sometimes I can come off sounding, you know, like a misanthrope, and I'm sorry about that. I think we will get to a I think we will get to a redemptive place toward the end. But right now, let's spend some time with a critical gaze at some of the ways that Christianity has tried to bring its values into the sports world, and how Christianity has tried to appropriate sport to prop up values, Christian values. The first one that first kind of phenomena I want to spend just a moment with is muscular Christianity. This is a movement in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in America. It was actually spawned in Britain, but was easily adapted to the American context in the early 1900s. Really, muscular Christianity really held and bared the anxiety of patriarchy at the time. Muscular Christianity found a home in men and male-run institutions in that time in America, who were feeling increasingly anxious about the feminization of American culture. Now, these fears around the feminization of the church and Christianity were also a part of this, that the church was becoming too feminine. There were more women in church than men, and so there was a lot of anxiety around this kind of watering down of masculinity during this time. And so Christianity and sport teamed up to try to buoy up what masculinity looks like and how, and to instill that with a kind of Christian context. So during this time, we see the birth of things like the YMCA. More and more churches were constructed with gymnasiums. Discipleship for young men became very tangled up with play and sport and toughness. And there was an increase in male-only spaces, like the Masons and things like that. So in order to kind of stop this kind of surge of femininity, literally muscular Christianity put its dukes up and fought back, you know. And that included this kind of hyper-athleticism that became the ideal of a Christian man. Now, during this time, the social gospel movement didn't help either, because Jesus was getting too feminine, too. That compassionate Jesus was not tough enough. I don't know if you all have read Touchdowns for Jesus. I'll just share with you a little vignette that is at the beginning of my chapter on gender. and this is a true story, a state university in 2011 at a mandatory football meeting. A preacher from an area non-denominational church who was invited to speak to the whole team at a mandatory meeting about toughness begins his talk by flashing up a traditional picture of Jesus. He proceeds to tell the players in a loud and aggressive voice that this picture makes Jesus look like a sissy, like a girl. Jesus wasn't a sissy, he was a warrior, he said. The preacher told the players that they needed to man up. Whether you start a fight or not, you should finish it. Jesus knew how to finish fights, and he was not a sissy. The preacher went on to explain to the football team that our culture has emasculated men and feminized Jesus. Man up, he said. Don't let this happen to you. The preacher was there with his three young sons. That's just a little taste of this kind of really a resurgence that we're seeing around needing to prop up the kind of ideal masculinity using Jesus, using Christianity. And I think we're going to continue to see that happening as gender fluidity becomes more normalized in the larger culture. It really is, football is the perfect template to protect hypermasculinity. It is the temple of hypermasculinity. This is a great resource. That's why I popped it up. If you're more interested in learning more about this, this is a great book. I'm sure John has probably other resources he would name too about muscular Christianity. But this is one of the best I know of by Clifford Putney. All right, let's move on to another example of the way Christianity and sports have teamed up. In parachurch movements, like the Fellowship of Christian Athletes and Athletes in Action. And I need to say this is not a... I was the president of the FCA in my high school, okay? I'm not saying that these are all bad or that... you know, that there's nothing good about what they've done. I am inviting us to look a little bit at these as a phenomena and what they have accomplished and how they have accomplished it. And then the kind of question that all of this begs is, where's progressive Christianity in this picture? Nowhere. There has been no effort on the part of other expressions of Christianity to build the relationships that these parachurch groups have. Years and years of hard work and of relationship building have really enabled these groups to have a powerful, powerful impact. When it comes to setting the tone for Christianity in big-time sports, that they're the only game in town, really. Athletes in Action places over half of the team chaplains in the NFL. The FCA was built on a model of basically capitalizing on the popularity of sports in order to bring people to Christ. So it's like, there's a shiny thing over there that everybody loves. Let's get a picture with it, and let's use it to our advantage. They realized that the relationships between coaches and players was a really, really powerful relationship, and so they could get coaches in the picture, then they could get players. And they also knew that people liked what players liked. So if players could sell, the quote from Don McLennan, I think is how you say his name, who was one of the FCA's founders, was that if athletes can endorse shaving cream, razor blades, and cigarettes, surely they can endorse the Lord. And so that is really the model. It has worked very effectively. FCA and Athletes in Action have provided countless hours of Bible study, support of players, teaching for coaches and athletes, and they have really guided athletes in terms of how to let sports be a platform for their faith. So when you see players kneeling at the 50-yard line or pointing up to the man upstairs when they score a touchdown. Those are all a part of just the kind of norms that they've learned in the discipleship that these parachurch groups have offered. The FCA was founded in 1954, and really since then has just spread like wildfire. It's a very male-dominated phenomena. I wonder how many girl presidents there have been of FCA. I'll have to look into that, but I'm proud to be one of them. Now, it's interesting to me because we've been very excluded from that world in our experience. In fact, as I tell about in the book, I was even kicked out of a Bible study, a women's Bible study, because I thought we might look at some other perspectives about being a wife other than that you should be submissive. I said, what if we read that one week and then another time we looked at some other stuff? And they said, you don't need to come back. And so I got kicked out of the Bible study. That was for the Carolina Panthers, with an athletes in action chaplain's wife leading the Bible study. The interesting thing is to me, because I've kind of occupied the margins in the conversation around Christianity and big time sport, is that many progressive Christians really reject that Christianity or God should have any role in sports. That God doesn't care about football. God doesn't care about sports. And I really balk at that too. What does that mean if God's just like, I see millions of people over there caring about something, but I don't care about that. I just don't see how that it all coheres with the covenantal God, the providential God that we say we believe in. So both extremes are problematic to me. You know, the belief that God, you know, shifts the wind to get a field goal where it needs to go, and the belief that God doesn't give a crap. I really do think God occupies all of these spaces with the same kind of prophetic and merciful love that we think God is, you know, giving us right here, right now. But the takeaway from here is really just the power of Christianity and sports to really create a culture together. I mean, this is a phenomenon, and this is a great resource. He, by his own admission, is not a sympathetic observer of these phenomena. In fact, he came to it, I think, as really a skeptic and a critic. But he does really end up in an appreciative place of just how effective it has been. The great thing about this book is he does his homework just on the history, and he does a lot of conversational research with people for whom this has meant a lot. So I found it to be a great resource. Again, John might have some other ones too, but this is one that has really helped me. Now, in a minute, we're going to talk about Clemson University. But before we get to Clemson, I just want to say that it is the norm for state universities to have an Athletes in Action or FCA chaplain that are not, they're not employed by the university, but they have full access to all athletes. They go on trips, they're on the team plane, they have no accountability to anybody in the university. They're often kind of in the back pocket of the head football coach or head basketball coach. They're the ones that kind of invite them in. They lead chapel services. They have direct access to players. Athletes in Action and FCA. Often there can be donations from like boosters, or sometimes the head coach even will pay for their salary. Now, I don't have to teach you all about the separation of church and state. You understand the, I mean, it's okay for us to practice our faith in state-run institutions. It's not okay for that institution to promote a certain expression of faith. And we have definitely been on teams where coaches said to players, if everybody on this team was Christian, we would be winning more. Well, every place we've been, it's been a problem. And there have been players who really felt alienated by it. And it's hurt the team. It has hurt the team in almost every context that we have been in. But as I said, we're going to talk in a minute about Clemson because they take it to a whole nother level. But I wonder, just kind of the question around, again, Christian understandings of who we are and what our role is in building relationships that help people learn about our faith. What does conversion mean in this context when we use our power to basically say, you need to believe in Jesus? Let's talk a little bit now. Those are two sort of vignettes of this attempt at partnership. I don't really see a consistent way that Christianity has had a life-giving impact in the world of sports. I can see where it's had an impact, sometimes good, sometimes not so good. But I think if we zero it all out, I don't think we get overall a life-giving impact. The Christianity that I understand and I practice is about healing. It's about grace. It's about justice. I believe Jesus was a healer. I believe Jesus was a source of grace and mercy. I believe he spoke truth to power. I believe he did not let injustice go unchallenged. I believe he was particularly concerned when it came to issues of economic justice, social boundaries and exclusion, and hypocrisy in the life of faith. I think we have a lot of examples of that in Scripture. So for me, Christianity really, it's hard for me to even recognize it if there's not some healing intention at the core. And I think Jesus calls us to be present in the world's suffering and injustice with this healing power that acknowledges, addresses, and transforms the world's worst wounds. So a profound question for me after looking at those two vignettes is just, how so many Christians can be so tangled up with sports but not bring the question of justice to the table? Why aren't more Christians asking about healing and justice in the world of sports? I don't know what the answer to that question is. But I want to look at three places now where I think we should hope that Christian values would show up. One, we talked about briefly yesterday because of a question that Isaac asked about head trauma. Our institutions of higher learning. Now, the NFL is a business, okay? Their unwillingness to deal with head trauma is a business decision. It's going to be expensive. It's going to cost them. So they're going to see if they can massage it to cost them less. That is a business decision, and everybody in the NFL is a commodity. There is no way in which people are valued as people. They do not care about your health. They do not care about your family. They do not care about any of those things. Unless it's a marketing opportunity or some kind of money-making thing, it's not going to find traction in the NFL. Period. The end. I don't care what you can't tell me that there's something else going on there. So I put that over in another category, their response to head trauma. Institutions of higher learning, though, shouldn't we expect better from them? They talk about that they are there to help young minds flourish. Minds, I understand, is sort of a metaphorical, you know, kind of whatever, bigger term, but doesn't that include your brain? I mean, I think it does. So these institutions were not created to generate profit. They were instituted to foster growth and learning. Their very purpose in life is the healthy formation of young minds. Now, we take that. That sounds like a good setting, right, for things to go well. And then we pop on top of that that a lot of people of faith are involved in athletic departments in institutions of higher learning. Seems like we've got a good bet there that some things would go well there too. If there's some really threat to people's literal ability to live a life in which they can function, I'm talking about just being in relationships with people. I'm talking about living. Doesn't it seem like those two contexts would really hop on that and be concerned? Now, superficially, you can look at the conversation around head trauma and think that there is attention to it. We're hearing more about it. There's a lot of concern. But the deeper that you dig, we can see that a lot of the concussion protocols that are out there right now are just, they're not addressing the problem. It's kind of like giving somebody vitamin C for cancer. I mean, maybe it'll make a little bit of something difference, but it's not really addressing the problem. The diagnostic tests that they do on the sidelines, which you'll notice in some of the big venue games now, are done in tents where no one can see what they're doing. Many of those sideline tests that are there to test players who are showing some symptoms really don't, it's too late by that time. I mean, if you're having trouble with balance, you've got a brainstem injury. If you passed out, you're way past, a concussion. You've got a serious brain injury on your hands. Helmets are confiscated when you show certain signs of not being able to either answer simple questions or follow somebody's finger or balance or whatever. This is supposed to be something that's a real sign of progress. Also, coaches are supposedly not making decisions about concussions anymore. It's still really tough for trainers to make those calls. I mean, it's a tough situation. It's not like it's just, oh yeah, it's easy now. Coaches aren't involved. Trainers are on that team. Trainers' jobs are on the line. They have just as much of a gray area, and sometimes even more than coaches do. Now, beneath the surface of these practices is some really good research that I talked a little bit about yesterday at Purdue about the harmful effects of the subconcussive hits, the little banging, banging, banging that players do in practice. They have proven in MRIs that they take before the season and then do periodically during the season, that players who never show any signs of a concussion have profound brain changes during the season. And they've also been able to determine that many of these brain changes don't recover from them. Some of them are cumulative. And many of these in players that are never diagnosed with a concussion. They kind of found this out by accident. The Purdue team refused to let them measure their players, so they did an area high school. And they wired the kids up at the beginning of the season, did the, preseason MRIs and stuff. And then they were sort of waiting for people to have a concussion. And luckily, nobody was having a concussion. I mean, that coach was really great about not doing a lot of hitting in practice. And so, they were kind of in this weird position of saying, well, is there anybody going to have a concussion so we could do an MRI? So they decided after a few weeks to just do some new imaging. And at first they thought, we messed up. Like, this can't be We must have messed up our stuff. This can't be the same people. And they began to realize that there were profound brain changes showing up in several of the players' MRIs who weren't symptomatic in any way and hadn't even experienced any of the big hits. What they were able to measure the G-force of hits, so they would go back to those players and say, well, what kind of hits have they been getting? A lot of them weren't getting the big ones. A lot of them were just, you know, kind of the everyday contact that you have in practice. This is really a game changer, that we could actually prevent head injuries by, one, not practicing with as much contact. What they were finding out, it was in practices that a lot of these things happen, not necessarily in games. The NFL has figured this out, and because they have a players' union, they don't have contact in practice because the players have power in the NFL. They don't in college football. They also have, as I said yesterday, developed new helmet technology. They borrowed from the auto industry, and they have worked on how helmets can absorb impact, because helmets now do not absorb impact. They're just there to prevent a skull fracture. Now, one would think all of these things would be something that the NCAA would be interested in, that universities would be interested in, that helmet companies would be interested in. And no one is touching it. No one is touching this. High schools are interested, it's not really getting any traction at the Division I college level. And the NCAA has pretty much signaled that it's just going to let universities live and die on their own about any liabilities or lawsuits that come along around a head trauma. They're just going to let that be something each university has to deal with. Whenever things get costly, the NCAA isn't in charge of college sports. And then whenever things get really a good source of revenue, then they are in charge of college sports. So where is Christianity in this issue? Here's an issue where we have a disease, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. It's completely preventable. Completely preventable. Where is Christianity's voice in this? Where is the voice of just the moral layer of institutions of higher learning? It's quiet. It's pretty quiet. And it's not just about head trauma, but just the quality of education that many athletes are able to receive. Even if they want to receive it, are they even able to receive it? And also just the quality of collegiate experience. There is a kind of deep ambivalence on the part of white dominant institutions that people of color and black and brown bodies should have the same space to discover themselves, to figure out who they are while they're in college. There is a different narrative that is attached to those bodies, and it is, well, you should just be thankful to be here. You're just lucky to be here, that you're just lucky that you got this opportunity. Well, of course you don't get to do what everybody else does. You should just feel good that you're here. We heard that over and over and over again. And so when a young man of color would come and say, well, I really wanted to major in X, just like David talked about yesterday, we've heard that story so many times. I want to major in criminal justice. I want to major in engineering or whatever it is. Well, you came here to play football, son. So, you know, you're majoring in football. And I've even heard some players start to appropriate that language and say, well, I'm majoring in football. And that's not because that's what they wanted or necessarily how they understood their college experience. But it's what the system teaches is they teaches them that they need to do to survive. And I do think, and not just survive, but that's how you get to stay. That's how you get to be a part of this. And so I do think that only works, that this is my main contention, this whole thing only works with white supremacy. Without white supremacy, this thing don't work. We would be outraged. We would, this would not be tenable for people. It would not. Just look at the difference in the reaction between the Duke lacrosse case that involved all white male students and then the UNC NCAA investigation that involved 18 young black students, and you get it. Completely different trajectory, reaction, institutional reaction, cultural reaction, and completely different outcomes for the people who were involved. So, real quickly, I want to make sure we get to Dabo land. We don't want to miss that, Dabo Sweeney land. A second place where it really shows up that we would hope we see Christian values, but I really don't see Christian values showing up a lot, is just the very clear streams of racism that are reflected in big-time sports. We talked some about this yesterday. We just were touching on it right now. I just want to add a few things to the mix. There are statistics. You can find them in my book. You can find them online. I mean, it's clear. We have a majority black and brown bodies generating the revenue. We have a majority white bodies benefiting from that and being in positions in which they have long-term access to wealth and accumulate wealth. Black and brown bodies generally are not accumulating wealth in this picture. White bodies, white male bodies are. But let's just add a few things to help you understand that the collegiate athlete is a different class of person on a college campus. Here are some of the things that they cannot do that other students can do simply because they are an athlete. They can't choose their own major. They can't participate in the social life of college. They can't participate in opportunities like study abroad or summer internships. They cannot start their own business or be entrepreneurs like other students. There is actually an NCAA regulation that says an NCAA athlete cannot start a business that has anything to do with their athletic ability. So, like, if I'm a tennis player and I want to give tennis lessons, I can't have a little flyer with my picture that says I want to give tennis. You can't do that. It's NCAA in violation. You cannot start a business where you're selling donuts, okay? It doesn't have to have anything to do with sports, and have your picture on it, because that's you using your image for profit and not the NCAA using your image for profit. You cannot use any reference of your participation on a sport team to get a job. Think about that. You can't put that on your resume while you're an NCAA athlete. That can't be a part of why you get a job. So if you're going to work at a t-shirt company and they know a booster, it can't be because, you know, you're a player at that school. Those are all things that regular students can do. All students can do, but athletes can't. Athletes cannot seek or employ a financial advisor. Athletes cannot seek and pay for professional representation for future employment. It is a felony offense in many states now for athletes to employ an agent. Tell me one other guild where that is true, where you couldn't have a headhunter working for you when you're looking for a job, or if you're going through job interviews, you can't have somebody helping you navigate the interview process. It is a violation of rights. That's why the activist group I'm a part of is called the Student Athletes Human Rights Project. These are rights. These are civil rights, human rights. The other thing that athletes do not have is any access to due process. So if they are accused of something and their literal scholarship or status as a student or even status as a law-abiding citizen, some of these are criminalized offenses, any of that hangs in the balance, they don't have any right to due process. In fact, they never get a hearing. There's no such thing as an NCAA hearing where an athlete is present. There's not one page in the hundreds and hundreds of pages in the NCAA rulebook about players' rights. They have no access to long-term health care for injuries sustained while playing. They do not have fair access to legal representation when under NCAA investigation. In fact, many of the North Carolina players were told, don't get a lawyer, you will look more guilty, you don't need a lawyer. They sign away their privacy rights when they sign a national letter of intent. Schools will seize cell phones without a warrant. They'll go through their emails without any permission to do so. They also are denied the opportunity to receive a fair wage for work while wearing the moniker of student athlete. And that's just a short list. Now, where is the Christian presence in sports speaking to this reality? I don't hear it. I don't hear it. The third place that Jesus is really seems concerned in Scripture, and he just puts a lot of energy into this. He's got a lot of good one-liners and zingers, and that is hypocrisy among people of faith. Now, us hypocrites, we're all over the place, okay? I'm guilty myself. And it's a deep conflict. We should all feel a deep conflict, not just about being sports fans, but being Americans, being Christians even. I mean, we should always have a troubling in our soul about these things. But let's go to the extremes. Let's go to one of the most outspoken Christians in big-time sports. I mean, he wears his Christianity on his sleeve. He's got a Bible in his back pocket. He runs a program in a state school and does not apologize for using his Christian values to build character in the student athletes, as he calls them, to use Christian values to define, you know, just how they do business. He employs a chaplain who has an office in the football office. They do baptisms on the practice field of students. This is a man who, when asked if players should be compensated, said, quote, if they do, I'll go do something else because there's enough entitlement in this world as there already. He gets paid $5.75 million a year. The players at Clemson get a check for $338 a month. But he won't coach football anymore because there's enough entitlement in the world if players get paid. When someone asked him what he thought about Black Lives Matter, he said these people need to move to another country. I think 80% of the players at Clemson are African American. I'm talking about Dabo Swinney. He's also an outspoken opponent of any kind of player activism. When asked about Colin Kaepernick's kneeling and not standing for the national anthem, he said, it's so easy to say we have a race problem, but we've got a sin problem. And anybody who did that on my team would be in trouble if they exercised that kind of dissent. So maybe some of you have heard about Dabo-land. Have you heard about Dabo-land? They have poured millions and millions of dollars into their football facility because they want to attract the best athletes. I want to take you on a virtual tour of Dabboland. This is the 9-hole putt-putt golf course. Yes. Lovely, huh? Just for football players. This is the covered basketball area. This is the wiffle ball court field. This is the indoor slide, because you need one of those. And then the replica of the hill that runs into Death Valley, they put that in the lobby. This is the players' nap room. Yeah, that's the players' nap room. And I've heard they won't let offensive linemen on the top bunks. This is the players' lounge. This is only a little bit part of it. They have a little bowling alley in there. This is the barber shop. Pretty nice, don't you think? So, Dabo is the extreme. This is a man who wears his Christianity on his sleeve, who unapologetically uses his Christian values to run this program. This is a man who's made no bones about the way he feels about any kind of issue that has to do with racial justice or economic justice. And this is what they do to take care of their players at Clemson. It's easy for us to demonize somebody like Dabo Swinney, but remember our definition of the demonic? It's not something outside of us. It's this penchant for distortion that we all have within us. It creates a distorted and truncated perspective. It blinds. It does not reveal. It makes something that's finite into something that's infinite, and it consumes the universe into itself. And remember this idea of divine dependence. It's when we place God at the center. It's when how we order our lives somehow feeds our relationship with God, when we know our place in the scheme of things. Now, in all of these situations, I think one of the biggest challenges is, how do we hear the voices of those most affected? And it was such a gift to hear David preach yesterday, because he has been there. He was a player, and he's leaving. I know it's not because I'm talking about him. But I would like for you all to listen to the voice of another player who has made a documentary called The Business of Amateurs. This is now available on iTunes and other places, and it would be a great resource in your churches or your classes about these issues of justice in sports. It's a great film. I hope you'll check it out. And Bobby DeMars, the player that made it, is a wonderful young man who is not going to give up on asking the questions that need to be asked. So I wonder if we kind of leave ourselves with this question of, why don't Christian fans, Christian boosters, Christian faculty, Christian athletic administrators, why don't we do a better job of bringing our faith to bear on the challenges that face the sports that we love? Concussions, questions of economic justice, racism, abuses of power, and other life-diminishing realities that exist in this world that captures our attention, our time, our hearts, even. So really, the question of how sports has affected congregations, for me, always and already, begs the question, how have congregations affected sports? My answer to the complaint that many progressive Christians have, that Christianity has taken up too much space in sports is that I believe Christianity hasn't taken up enough space in sports. I want to hear your questions, and I want to leave you with some other resources. If you go to my website and go to the Sports Reform page, there's several short videos that I made with former players and other activists, specifically for players. Those are there to help players know their rights. And if there's ever any way those can be useful to you, I hope you'll use them. And I know everybody that's in those films, in those videos, would also be willing to talk to you directly or be involved in any way in your community. ShoopsGoingDeep.com, that's where you can find the podcast that John and I have. We have shows on concussions. We have shows on justice. We have shows on the economics of collegiate sports. So many mythologies around things like scholarships and things like that. I hope you'll take a listen to the conversations with Andy Schwartz. He really debunks a lot of myths around scholarships and things like that. We also have a show with former player Devin Ramsey that is, again, another opportunity to hear directly from a player what his experience was like. Those are just some resources I want to offer you, and I just hope that you're unsettled. I hope that you feel the need to really work some new muscle groups and to really up your game. We all need to. We all need to up our game. And if we thought when we got here that the worst thing about sports and congregations was travel soccer teams, I hope that is a long and distant memory to you now. And you have a little bit more meat on the bone about what some of our challenges are as people of faith. So thank you.